Y.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowane. The beheadings of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff at the hands of a group calling itself Islamic State are stark reminders of the risks journalists face when reporting news from the world's most dangerous places. Joining us to talk about the challenges of reporting from hotspots across the globe is Robert Mahoney. He's a deputy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and he joins us from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. Now, your group maintains a webpage with some grisly statistics. The headline says 1,077 journalists killed since 1992. And then there's a graph at the top of the webpage showing yearly death statistics. And for the past decade, those numbers have been higher. Do we know why that is?
Well, there's been an upsurge in the killing of journalists because of conflict, particularly since the Arab uprisings of 2011. And there's been crackdowns on the press across the world. But at the moment, the most deadly place for journalists is in Syria and Iraq.
Right. And on that same webpage, you have a list of the 20 most deadliest countries, the 20 deadliest countries for journalists. Iraq, still number one there, it says 166 deaths. But that kind of changes as conflict zones change around the world, then, you're saying.
Yeah, there are two main causes of death for journalists in dangerous places. One is crossfire, that's being caught on a battlefield or being just in the wrong place at the wrong time when a car bomb goes off. And then there are the equally important is the murder of journalists. Many, many journalists around the world are actually murdered, targeted deliberately because they've been reporting on corruption or trying to root out other stories. And you see this particularly in countries like Mexico, where the drug cartels have targeted journalists in the past, but also in Pakistan. Lots of journalists killed there reporting on not just the Taliban, but also on what the Pakistani government is doing. So it's a mixed picture. There's conflict reporting, and then there's investigative reporting, both of which put journalists in danger.
I was a little surprised by one country on that list, the Philippines. What's going on there?
Well, there's been a history, unfortunately, of impunity in the killing of journalists. It's very cheap to get a journalist killed in the Philippines. A few thousand dollars will buy you an assassin to go and silence someone who is causing you problems, if you're a government official, a politician, or whatever. And then back 3 or 4 years ago, there was a huge killing of journalists, more than 30 in the southern Philippines. They were ambushed. They were following a governor that was going to register as a candidate in an election. They were ambushed by a rival, and more than 30 of them were killed. So that massacre in Maguindanao province is the reason for the huge uptick in the Philippines.
And so we're talking a lot about journalists in other countries and the risks of reporting in other countries. I think one thing that also surprised me is you have these really interesting breakdowns, and I advise if you're interested in looking at this as we're talking about it and you're near a computer for our listeners, you can go to the website for the Committee to Protect Journalists and see it right there. Print journalists seem to be more at risk than broadcast journalists, at least statistically. What's going on there with those statistics?
Well, in a lot of countries in the developing world, print is still pretty important. I mean, you know, in the United States and in lots of Western European countries, online journalism has taken over broadcast. But in Africa and in many Asian countries, print journalists are still at the forefront of news gathering, particularly the kind of news gathering that I was talking about earlier, investigative reporting, uncovering, you know, wrongdoing in government, uncovering corruption in business. These usually appear in print, and those journalists are at great risk. That's why they make up the bulk. But there is a new trend, which is that more and more journalists are now using online platforms, websites, social media to do their reporting, and that is a significant component of our death and casualty figures.
And are we talking exclusively about journalists here? Because there are a lot of people who help journalists do their work in difficult places, people like fixers. Maybe we should describe what a fixer is.
That's a very important point. A fixer is a person who is often a local journalist who helps foreign journalists who come in from outside navigate the society. They speak the language, they know the culture, they have the contacts. I've been a journalist myself for many, many years, and I can tell you that you cannot operate without fixers. And they're the ones who, after you go home, have to remain. They live there. And if they've upset people, they bear the consequences. So fixers are more than just drivers, although they can be drivers sometimes, and they're more than just translators, although they're all often that. They are the people that get you as a reporter to the people that you need to speak to. They get you the appointments, they get you the interviews, and they help you out of dangerous situations.
And so these are folks who know, I guess when you're a reporter and you're going into an environment where you haven't spent a lot of time, to use that line from the former defense secretary, you don't know what you don't know, and a fixer might know more than you know.
Absolutely. And remember, you as a foreigner are coming into a society. People don't know you. It may be a conflict area. They're suspicious. What are your motives? Are you a spy? Why are you here? You need a local person whom they can trust, who they may know, either through they went to school with him or they know the family or whatever, that can get you into that society and can bring you to the people that you need to speak to in safety. You can't just walk into a refugee camp in Syria. You can't just walk into a neighborhood in Gaza without a fixer, because you're immediately suspicious and people won't talk to you.
You've already mentioned this, but often people who target journalists and murder journalists, they often don't get brought to justice. There's a statistic on your website that says 88% of murders are never brought to justice.
Yeah, this is a huge problem, because it means that in some countries it's always open season on pesky journalists. We at the Committee to Protect Journalists have been pushing for an end to what we'll call impunity, that is to say, you know, getting away with murder, literally. And the UN has adopted this and made November 2nd as the International Day to End Impunity. This was prompted in part by this huge massacre of journalists that I mentioned earlier in the Philippines. But in many countries, journalists are easy targets, and if government officials, businessmen, criminals can get away with murdering them, then it has a chilling effect on the whole press corps in that country. And what happens is you see this terrible cancer on press freedom, which is self-censorship. This has happened in Mexico in particular, right here on the border of the U.S., where the drug cartels have frightened and intimidated many Mexican journalists into silence through terrible, grisly murders and kidnaps. And unless those people are brought to justice, then journalists will have to protect themselves. And one way they do that is by literally not reporting the news.
And so how can that be changed? Because you can't just tell another country, you know, you need to be prosecuting these people. I guess you can tell them, but you can't force them to do it. But how do you sort of address that issue?
You're right. You can't force people, but you can shame them into it. You can just make yourself a nuisance, if you like, as a voice that is constantly bringing up this issue, so that when the leaders of these countries come into international forums like the UN here in New York last week, it is raised. And it makes them think about it as a problem, and sometimes they will act. It's very difficult. It's long work. But, for example, in Mexico, through the work of the Committee to Protect Journalists and other groups, we've got crimes against journalists now taken to the federal level from the state level, because a lot of the state prosecutions were ineffective, or they didn't take place, or there was more corruption at the state level. It's now gone to the federal level, where we hope there will be a more efficient and more diligent pursuit against these killers. But you're right, it is extremely hard work, but we do see some success, and we do have prosecutions brought against killers of journalists. The one country where we've seen a little success is Brazil. One wouldn't think of Brazil as being a place where journalists are particularly in danger, but actually in the interior in Brazil, journalists are in danger, and there's several of them have been killed. But we are getting assurances from the government in Brazil that it will prosecute the killers of journalists.
And we're not just talking about killing here. That's not the only risk that journalists face overseas. Is there's kidnapping. That's a big risk now too, right?
It's huge. I mean, you know, for your listeners that can remember the 1980s, there was a wave of kidnappings during the Lebanese Civil War, and a number of Americans were held, some of them for nearly 7 years. One hostage, Terry Anderson, was famously held for nearly 7 years. But that was the exception rather than the rule. What we've seen in the last few years since the Syrian Civil War broke out is a plague of kidnapping. According to our figures, we've documented some 80 kidnappings since 2011 in Syria, most of them Syrian journalists, by the way. And of those, around 20 are still held. Now, some were kidnappings that we know about, like James Foley and Sadloff and others. But there's lots of Syrians there. But it's become so dangerous. And this is a way that ISIS, the so-called Islamic State group, has used to finance itself by capturing Western journalists, particularly Europeans, and holding them for ransom.
And not just a little bit of ransom. I mean, in the Islamic State case with James Foley, they were seeking $132 million in ransom.
Yeah, that was off the charts. And I mean, a lot of the people that were dealing with that case believed that because that was so high, it wasn't really serious. The journalists that those kidnappers are particularly interested in are the European journalists, not the British ones, but the other Europeans. And there's been lots of reports in the media of how France, Germany, Denmark, and Spain, and other countries have allowed ransom to be paid in order to get their journalists free. And don't forget that a lot of these journalists in Syria were held at some point during their captivity in the same room. So the Europeans that were held with James Foley were let go on payment of money, and he paid the price with his life.
And so what is the advice to these news organizations that where a ransom is requested? What do they do?
Well, the news organizations have different ways of dealing with it. I mean, obviously, according to the reports that we've all seen and have been particularly well documented in the New York Times recently, they have paid. The governments have paid. Businesses have paid. I mean, it's not just journalists that are kidnapped. Aid workers and other people are kidnapped, too, where they've been tourists, even, where ransom has been paid. It is a stated policy of the United States government, of the British government, and a few others that they will not pay ransom. Okay. So any journalist and any news organization that is either sending people into a situation where they could be kidnapped has to take that into account.
Okay, and we'll have to pick up that point in a minute. We're talking about the challenge of reporting from dangerous places with Rob Mahoney of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He'll be speaking on a panel entitled Journalism on the Ground, the Risks and Importance of International Reporting at the World Affairs Council in Philadelphia this Thursday at 7:15 p.m. After a break, NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers is going to join our conversation. You can join us, too. Call 1-888-477-9499 or email radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be back.
Mount Cuba Center supports WHYY and hosts the First Saturday's Family programs on the first Saturday of October and November. Featuring family fun activities, these programs take place in Mount Cuba's native gardens. Saturday, October 4th, will be a celebration of art in the garden, open to the public. Mount Cuba Center is a botanical garden located in Hockessin, Delaware, that promotes the conservation of native plants. More on First Saturdays, course offerings, and visiting hours at mtcubacenter.org.
Hi, I'm filmmaker Ken Burns. You choose WHYY because you appreciate the shows it delivers every day. Because it offers something different, WHYY provides trustworthy news coverage, offers a gateway to the arts, and educates viewers and listeners of all ages with support from individuals like you. Visit WHYY.org or call 888-345-9499. And as always, thank you.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady. We're talking about what it's like to be a journalist working in some of the world's most dangerous places. We have Rob Mahoney from Committee to Protect Journalists with us from New York. We're also going to bring into the conversation Kelly McEvers. She's a correspondent based at NPR West. After many years in the Middle East, she is at NPR West. She previously ran NPR's Beirut Bureau. And last year, she released a radio documentary with producer Jay Allison of Transom.org. It's called Diary of a Bad Year, A Correspondence Dilemma. Welcome to Radio Times, Kelly McEvers.
Hi, thanks for having me.
That was an excellent documentary, and I have to say, if any of our listeners, if you haven't heard it yet, go to transom.org. You can listen to it and hear about Kelly's experience. Tell us about some of the dangerous places that you've been over your career.
Iraq, Syria, Yemen, those are probably the most interesting ones of the last few years. I actually was posted in Iraq in 2010, which was probably the least dangerous time now that we look back to be there over the last decade or so. But then the Arab Spring happened, and, you know, the old order in all of these countries across the Middle East started to unravel. Even Iraq had its own protest movement, and that's where things started to unravel and to the point where you see it today.
And I've heard stories from you where we can hear the sound of shooting there. What is it like to be in a place where people are shooting guns? They may not be trying to direct the fire at you, but just being around that, or even being around where tear gas canisters are being fired, what's that like?
It's so funny, because when you're in the middle of doing it, I think you don't really stop and think, well, what is this like? Well, this is weird. I mean, you're just kind of thinking to yourself, this is my job. It's what I have to do day in and day out. But then you sort of step back and think, oh, wow, my mother's going to hear that on the radio. And what must that be like? So, I mean, I think in the moment, it's just part of the day's work. I know that sounds crazy, but it's what we were sent there to do. We're sent there to witness and report on what we're seeing. And if there's chaos going around us, that's what we're there to report. And I have to say, I mean, I think people don't always talk about this, but there is kind of a level of excitement to it. I wouldn't go so far as to say fun, but, you know, there's something that happens in our bodies when we're in a dangerous situation. There's a surge of adrenaline, sort of the fight or flight chemicals. You start to see things really clearly. The smells are really intense. And in some ways, that makes you even better at your job. You know, we're there to record every single detail, and you can do that because of what's happening in your body. So there's this strange level of awareness and excitement that comes with it, too. I'm not so much a believer in this idea of adrenaline addiction. I'm not sure that's really true, but I don't think it's the thing that keeps you going back into the war, but there is this sense of being very alive when you're in the middle of something like that.
And you're there by yourself as a member of NPR, maybe with your fixer, but there's this other group of journalists around you, and you all call yourself the tribe? I think that would be a term new to her.
I don't know where that came from. I just heard it from a number of people. I mean, sadly, it's a phrase that came up after we started losing people, losing members of the tribe. And, you know, Chris Hondros and Tim Hetherington, two photographers who died in Libya, Anthony Shadid, brilliant New York Times reporter who died in Syria, not in combat, but Marie Colvin, and of course the dozens and dozens of Syrian citizen journalists who we knew and worked with very, very closely who were killed. And, you know, you started to see, you know, on one night simultaneously, you could see on social network, you know, people literally all around the world lighting candles and putting people's cameras out as for vigils, you know, and we started to realize there is this kind of global tribe of people who do this job and who believe in this job and who think it's an important job to do despite the risks. And that's really where that came from.
And you already described some of the physical things that you experience when you're doing this work. But at one point in your documentary, you talk about beginning to see things in slow motion. Tell me what that was like.
That was another physical thing. I mean, that was actually after the death of two of my colleagues, of Chris and Tim in Libya, these two photographers in Libya. And it was the strangest thing. I wasn't anywhere near Libya. I was in Iraq at the time. But knowing that I knew people who were there when they died, seeing the way the tribe was grieving and having these sort of existential questions about, whoa, why do we do this? Should we do this? What's going on? Strange things happened to me physically. I just started seeing things in slow motion. I would pass my hand in front of my face, and it was like it just felt like it was kind of trying to move through like some kind of viscous substance or something. It was very weird.
Wow.
And I actually, called a psychotherapist who NPR has on retainer and talked to him about it. And, he said, it's basically trauma. I mean, this is what happens when you go through a trauma. Even though I wasn't there, I didn't actually witness the trauma, there's something traumatic about, losing a friend and thinking about what you're doing with your own life. And that's really what it was. It was very strange. It lasted about a day. But, these are the things that sometimes hit you when you least expect it.
I'm going to bring Rob Mahoney from the Committee to Protect Journalists back into the conversation here. And Rob, what you hear Kelly describing, you've reported in difficult places too. Does that sound familiar to you?
It does. I think one of the big differences is that now journalists are more connected as a group. There was a time when editors would just say, okay, there's a war, go cover it, and off you'd go. And there was no training. There was very little equipment. This was my personal experience. And what happened in the 90s with the Balkan War and with journalists getting in trouble and getting killed there is that news organizations started to take their responsibilities more seriously and started these hostile environment and first aid training courses for journalists. And they slowly began to give people training on how to handle this situation. Before you went, you watched what older journalists, more experienced journalists did, and you imitated them because that was a way of staying safe. So there's been a big improvement there. Mm. And the other thing that Kelly mentioned, which is psychological support after you've been in a conflict zone or witnessed, this again was something that didn't exist a few years ago. In fact, many journalists in that kind of bravura way they had of saying, hey, I'm fine. I don't need to go and see a shrink. But now it's been shown that journalists, just like soldiers, suffer post-traumatic stress disorder and need counseling. Those that don't go through bouts of, alcoholism or violence against themselves or others. And there is a center called the DART Center, which is part of Columbia University Journalism School, which provides support and information. And all big, responsible news organizations now have access to these services, which they provide for their journalists. So it's improved tremendously, but so too has the conflict, and there are now more journalists out there that are exposed to this. So it's kind of meeting a need, but the need keeps growing.
That's Rob Mahoney. He's Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's with us for the whole hour. We also have Kelly McKevers, NPR correspondent, for about 10 more minutes. If you want to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kelly, you started asking, why do we do this work? And you got different answers from different people. You really kind of cast a net there to sort of get some advice on why people do this work.
Right. I went from, some really well-known correspondents, Christian Amanpour from CNN, Sebastian Younger, well-known for, his books, his reporting in Africa, and of course his making of the film Restrepo in Afghanistan, and John Lee Anderson from The New Yorker. I mean, I got just a really interesting range of different answers. I mean, I think one of the most interesting ones was the daughter of a correspondent who had been killed in El Salvador in the 80s. Her name's Anna Blundy. And You know, she said, don't kid yourselves. You know, you're not doing this for some noble reason. You do it because it's fun. My father did it because it's fun. He chose his work over me, and now he's gone, and I'll never have him back. It was a very intense and difficult conversation because basically it was, you know, fast forward thinking about my own daughter and how she would feel.
And this was that conversation came just as you were planning to go undercover in Syria, right?
Right. Yeah, I was planning a trip into Syria. Things were really difficult. It was before the kidnappings had started, but you know the risks were still really great. I mean, the risks to myself and the risks to the Syrians who'd be working with me were so great. And there were already stories that, you know, if you were helping a journalist who was going in undercover, that the Syrian could be detained and beaten or even worse, you know, so it was a really dicey, you know, set of decisions that I was thinking about and had that conversation with her thinking, oh my gosh, this could be my own daughter 40 years later, you know, saying these things. And I canceled the trip. I mean, I was already feeling a little weird about the trip, and that was enough to just say, you know, no, it's not happening this time.
Right. You did go later. And when you do that sort of work where the government doesn't want you to be there, you're hanging out with the rebels, how do you know that the people you've picked to be with are going to keep you safe?
Right. I mean, this is what we saw with Jim Foley and some of the others. You know, they went in with people they thought they could trust, and you know, without going into too much detail, because I don't know all the details, you know, certain people maybe gave away their location or gave them up to other people. And so knowing who you were going with and trying to figure out if you could trust them was obviously of the utmost importance. When we would sneak over the Turkish border and go into Syria and basically embed with these rebels. Again, you know, because we are closer and more networked now, especially via social media, we had this whole chain of communication among the journalists. There was actually a secret Facebook group that we use to discuss, you know, which drivers, which fixers to trust, which roads are good, what, you know, what things we had seen, you know, who had been in the most recently and what they had seen in different towns and cities. You could post a question, hey, has anybody been to X lately? Hey, has anybody used this guy lately? You know, what do you think about, you know, this crew? You know, I saw some shady stuff going on here. So there's this constant stream. In addition to sort of following the news and doing your job, there's this constant sort of other current of information that we were following to try to figure out, you know, who were the most, what were the most trustworthy routes to get in and out of the country.
Wow. Rob Mahoney, I can imagine times in the past when you were reporting from difficult places, it might have been nice to have that secret Facebook group.
Absolutely. There are quite a few. And I mean, one of the reasons that there has to be that group, too, is that there are now more freelancers in the field. A lot of these dangerous places were covered by news organizations that had either staff or retained freelancers going there with an assignment. What's happened in the last few years with the advent of cheap technology is that more independent journalists can go and publish or file their stories at no great cost. So there are more people out there, and they need some kind of cohesive group to share information.
I definitely want to talk more about freelancers coming up in a little bit here. But right now, I also want to focus on the kind of training that news organizations who send their people into difficult environments, what kind of training they do. Kelly McEvers, what kind of training did NPR provide for you?
Well, it's called hostile environment training. It's required of everyone. Yeah,
I just went through it about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we're really widening the net of who it goes through it, because I think there are hostile environments right here at home, right? And there's also the chance that anybody could be sent overseas for different stories at any time, and you want to be prepared. You know, it's run by these sort of usually these ex, you know, British Special Forces type guys who run these companies, security companies, basically. And you spend a week learning about everything from how to wrap a wound, you know, how to bandage a gunshot wound, to, you know, how do you behave when you get kidnapped, to, you know, you run through scenarios like a checkpoint where there's like hostile actors, you know, who are, don't want you to get through the checkpoint for one reason or another. And you talk about landmines, you talk about weapons, you know, how long can you hide behind a wall while it's being shot at before you have to move? Like, really practical things that you obviously wouldn't know or think about as a journalist. And it really does change the way you think about things. I think probably one of the most important elements of the training, as far as I'm concerned, is the first aid. I mean, there are times when maybe you're not directly involved in combat, but somebody in your team could get hurt by maybe some shrapnel, a stray bullet, something like that. You want to be able to help that person in that situation when there's no medical help nearby. And there have been cases where people have bled out, you know, from pretty simple wounds and could have been helped had the people with them had first aid training.
And it's not always injuries from fighting. I mean, as I understand it, one of the biggest risks to journalists overseas are car accidents.
Car accidents, yeah. I mean, you're in these, you know, banana republics with not many traffic laws, and you're going from one dicey area to another, and the guy's on the wrong side of the road, and it's raining, and, you know, yeah, I mean, that's a huge risk, and you want to be able to be prepared to take care of people so that you can, you know, have a secure situation to get back in the car and get away if you need to.
And Rob Mahoney, this hostile environment training, you're familiar with this. Is this something that you saw early in your career?
No, as I said earlier, it came about, I think, in the late 90s. When I was first sent out to cover civil wars in Asia or Africa, we had no training. I was the bureau chief for Reuters News Agency for 7 years in Jerusalem. And when things started to heat up there, we had cameramen coming in from around the world, and they were getting hit on the head. They started wearing football helmets and cricket helmets as an improvisation until such time as the organization I worked for said, hey, we got to do something properly about this. And they started going to these companies that Kelly was just mentioning. And it became standard practice after that. But it wasn't the case. And a lot of freelancers that go out there don't have necessarily access to this training because it's expensive. It's many thousands of dollars for a week's training. And then the training's only good for a while. You have to go back and keep it current because these trainers are always fighting the last war. They're talking about the dangers of the last conflict. Dangers change, and you need more. You need more training, particularly in first aid.
And now, Kelly McEvers, back to you. You're working out of NPR West now, a little less hostile. Do you ever feel the pull back towards some of these conflict zones here? And just about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anybody really wants to cover the story about the Islamic State, and it's not like you can get a visa to the Islamic State right now, but do I want to tell the stories of the people whose lives are being affected by these guys? Absolutely. Do I know every single corner of Iraq and feel sort of, you know, a duty to tell those stories? Yes. But, you know, right now it's somebody else's turn to do that. Our people in the field are doing an amazing job. There's a lot of really good, interesting, important stories back here in the States to do, so I'm okay for now.
All right. That's NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers. I highly recommend listening to her documentary. It's called Diary of a Bad Year on Transom.org. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
And when we come back, we'll have Rob Mahoney for the rest of the hour. He's with the Committee to Protect Journalists. You can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be back after a break.
The Executive MBA at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY and is proud to announce the Executive MBA's relocation to the Hub Commerce Square at 20th and Market Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. In only one weekend per month for 16 months, the Executive MBA is designed to help you expand your leadership and business skills needed to succeed in a complex global economy. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/EMBA.
We're all born curious. It's what gets us to learn and grow. But only some people continue exploring, learning, and discovering throughout their lifetimes. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear about a new book that explores the desire to know and how it impacts our lives and careers. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey, presents the Festival of Fine Craft, Saturday and Sunday, October 4th and 5th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., both days, rain or shine. This arts festival celebrates the best of American craft. The event features traditional and contemporary work from over 130 juried artists, plus indoor and outdoor craft demonstrations, hands-on family activities, musical entertainment, specialty foods, and the popular glass pumpkin patch. Details online at wheatonarts.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the dangers reporters face around the world with Rob Mahoney. He's Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. And Rob, just listening to what Kelly was saying there, and that is those experiences of being in those difficult places, you have to wonder, are reporters ever tempted to arm themselves to try and make sure that they have some sort of protection? Do reporters ever carry guns?
In the main, no. There are some local reporters maybe in certain areas that may carry guns, but foreign journalists do not, on the whole, carry guns. Journalists are civilians, and it's that protection of being a civilian that would be lost if you had a gun. For example, if you get pulled from a car at a checkpoint in Syria, and you say, I'm a journalist, and they frisk you, and you've got a gun, then you've just, as far as they're concerned, you're hostile. You could be a spy. You could be anybody. So it could get you killed carrying a gun.
Hmm. We do send journalists into these environments with special gear, though, right?
Absolutely. Protective gear. I mean, you know, it's now standard that people will wear a bullet-resistant vest. You've seen them on TV, probably. They're usually colored blue. They've got Kevlar plates that slot into a vest, front and back, to protect, you know, your vital organs. They will wear a hard hat, like a helmet, to try to protect against, shrapnel or stones, or depending on where you are. But that's about it. And then there are other ways that journalists do protect themselves. I won't go into all of them now because some of them, you know, it's better if we don't publicize everything that people do. But another thing that news organizations have done over the years is to provide hard cars rather than soft-sided cars. So as you're protected from bullets and to a certain extent from landmines, because I've known journalists who've driven over landmines and been injured. And others, of course, in Iraq, we saw with these roadside bombs that were lethal, not just for troops, but also for journalists. So there are many ways that journalists can protect themselves physically. But in the end, you know, they're not armed. They are civilians. They don't wear a uniform and they don't carry a weapon.
How long have you been a journalist reporting for some of these difficult places?
Oh, goodness. I'll give my age away here. I started in 1978, and I worked for 25 years for Reuters, which is an international news agency, and I worked in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and Europe for them. And for the last 7 years, I've been with the committee, which is a group that was formed by journalists to help journalists.
Okay. And we're going to go to the telephone if you'd like to join the conversation. It's 1-888-477-9499. We have Don on the line. Don from, says, the Jersey Turnpike, so you must be driving. I hope you're careful.
Yes, I am. Thanks. I just wanted to ask one quick question on the more subtler forms of pressure or threats that journalists face in countries such as Russia and China.
Rob Mahoney, the subtler forms of pressure that journalists face in places like Russia or China.
Okay, well, the pressure in Russia runs the whole gamut, right? From murder, because there's been a large number of journalists that have been murdered in Russia since Putin first came to power in 2000. But the other pressures that they face are threat of jail. Threat of violence in Russia. Lots of journalists get beaten up. Job losses. They could go after the family if the spouse is employed. They could lose their job. There are all kinds of ways that pressure can be put on journalists. And one thing that's happened in Russia is that newspapers and broadcasters have come under commercial pressure. And Putin has basically bought out most TV and radio. There are very few left. So the pool in which an independent journalist could work has shrunk. Completely. In China, it's the threat of jail. China is one of the worst jailers of journalists in the world. There are more than 30 journalists in jail there now. And lots of threats of intimidation against employers, against news outlets, and then against the families too. It's quite an intimidating atmosphere in which to work as an independent journalist.
And can we see evidence that this kind of intimidating atmosphere has affected coverage in places around the world?
Absolutely. I mean, in Russia, you do not see critical coverage. Russians don't see critical coverage, at least outside. There are still foreign correspondents in Russia who can report. But Russians, if you'd looked at Russian television or listened to Russian radio, you wouldn't have thought that Ukraine was happening at all. It was a completely different cast that was put on the news. In China, too, you don't see investigative journalism into the corruption, which you read about in the Western press, of corruption amongst Chinese officials. Chinese don't see that. And don't forget, in China, they have their own internet. They have behind the firewall, the great firewall of China, what you get in your search results and what you get on your websites is very different from what we outside see.
We're going to go back to the telephone for another question for Rob Mahoney from the Committee to Protect Journalists. We have Marjorie in Philadelphia. Marjorie, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hey.
How are you? I was a correspondent many years ago in Vietnam, and I can tell you there was a rule. You listen. I was a TV reporter. You listened to your cameraman, period. You could see the most fabulous shot you've ever seen in the world, say, I'd like to get that, and he would say, we're not going down that road. And I was with the cameraman who got that amazing shot of the general shooting the as the soldier who.
Oh, of course.
And I this is really does age me, but it used to be when we had rabbit ears on the top of the camera, and the general said, if you don't give us that shot, you're a dead man. And he opened up the other rabbit ear, the one on the left with non-exposed film, and he gave him all of that film, and then we got him out of the country. He left, the cameraman. He came back eventually.
Wow, this work of being in difficult environments has been a problem for a long time, Rob Mahoney.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a good point. I mean, for TV, for example, when I did TV too, you had a cameraman or camera person, and you also had a sound man, and they were your eyes and ears. The sound man also had the back of the cameraman who was looking through a lens. Now, journalists like James Foley, for example, did it all. He was shooting video, he was doing writing, he was doing audio as well. And so the only way that he could have some protection would be to buddy up with other journalists. But journalists have been exposed always. I mean, there were journalists who were killed in Vietnam. There were journalists who were kidnapped in Cambodia back in the 60s and the 70s. This is not new. What is new is the scale of the threats. It's just much more widespread. And journalists have become targets themselves, prized either for their political or their financial gain to the kidnappers.
And you mentioned this already, but a lot of outlets, media outlets, have turned to freelancers for coverage, and that presents its own problems.
Absolutely. Well, what's happened is that a big international broadcasters and also city papers have shrunk their foreign bureau network for financial reasons, as the news industry is in constant change. And so there are fewer bureaus, there are fewer staff correspondents, and so they turn to freelancers. Some of them, some of the news organizations are good towards their freelancers in that they provide them with the proper training and the proper equipment and will take up their case if something happens to them. Others have an arm's length relationship with freelancers, and these are the practices that we now have to try to change, so that people don't go to war zones with no assignment, no contract, and assigning editor in New York or in London or Paris has said, well, we're not going to send you anywhere, but if you get some decent material, if you get some nice shots, bring them in, we'll take a look.
Mm. Yeah, and if these are a lot of folks who, trying to get ahead and make a name for themselves, and they might take risks that other people wouldn't. That just seems like definitely a problem. And freelancers might be working for more than one outlet. How do you choose which one of those outlets is responsible for that person's safety?
Yeah, I mean, in order to make a living as a freelancer, you can't just work for one outlet. By definition, otherwise you'd be, on staff because you'd be being paid quite well. The word gets around. The freelancer community, as we were saying when Kelly was on, is much more connected. There are groups on Facebook. There are listservs. There are sharing platforms. And good employers and bad employers get known. So the freelancer has to take responsibility for his or her own safety. And one of the ways they do that is by information sharing. I think these kidnappings and these brutal beheadings that we've seen in the last few months are a wake-up call to any freelancer that thinks that they can just pitch up in a conflict zone and find work. I think it shows that you can't do that, that you have to take precautions and you have to plan. It's not the Wild West anymore.
Hmm. We're also seeing more, I guess we call them citizen journalists, especially in places like Syria after the Arab Spring a few years back. They have even less formal relationships with outlets that might end up airing or showing their work.
Absolutely. When the protests first broke out in Syria, ordinary Syrians went down into the street with cameras and phones and recorded it, and they kept going. But as the fighting got worse, they were taking more risks. Fewer foreign journalists were coming out, so it was important that we get their pictures. The trick here for foreign organizations is to be able to know, amongst those citizen journalists, who are gathering news as journalists and who have a political or other agenda and are more activists than journalists. But that's something that that news editors have to work out.
Hmm. Getting back to the freelancers working in difficult environments, Stephen Sotloff, he was a freelancer. He was working for, I guess, Time magazine and some other publications. He was kidnapped a long time ago, August 2013. I don't think most of us were aware for much of the last year that he had been kidnapped.
Correct. A lot of the kidnappings are not reported. Sometimes it's because the kidnappers say if you report this, the hostage will be in danger. But often it's the government or the security advisors that are retained by the news organizations that want to keep control of the message and do not want it to be known. There was a point, at one point in the Syria conflict, there were some 30 hostages held and it wasn't really reported, which was basically the public didn't know the scale of the problem. These media blackouts, there's a debate raging at the moment. Are they effective? Are they not effective? But it's still the case that when a journalist is kidnapped, if a news organization asks that other journalists don't report that these requests are respected.
Hmm. And what do you think of that?
Well, I think in the debate there's a lot of questioning, as I said, of the effectiveness. I think that we have to be very careful not to endanger the journalist. We're the Committee to Protect Journalists, so we're not going to do anything that goes against the wishes of the family or the employer if it goes directly to the safety of that person. But I think there's a case to be made for reporting that a person has been kidnapped at the outset, and then maybe not reporting every detail if there are negotiations going on and giving publicity to the kidnappers. But I think that there is a purpose to be served by having the scale of the problem known.
And then there's always the question of, once a journalist has been kidnapped, what do you do? And there's a question for the outlet that they work for, but also for the family of that person. And in Stephen Sotloff's case, we saw the video of his mother pleading for her son's life. Do we know if that had any effect on his what happened to him ultimately?
Well, it was very late in the game, and I don't know, but I don't imagine that it had a great effect. I mean, one of the reasons that the Sotloff family wanted to keep quiet the kidnapping of their son was that he was Jewish and was, in fact, I think he had an Israeli passport. Those were pieces of information that were not going to help him if it got out there into the public domain. So there's an instance of where keeping quiet about that part of the kidnapping was probably very prudent. But in terms of other kidnappings, it depends who has taken the hostage. When we had a rash of kidnappings of journalists in Somalia, where they went to cover the piracy, that was often just criminal. And the reasoning was, you keep quiet about it, otherwise you keep inflating the importance of the hostage and the price will go up and the negotiations will drag on. That was one argument. There are often times when journalists are taken, they're accused of being spies. At that point, publicity probably will help. And we've intervened in cases of journalists being taken in Iraq, for example, where we can point to their work, show that these are real, genuine journalists, they're not spies, and the only way you can do that is by reporting on the kidnapping. So it varies from kidnap to kidnap what kind of reaction the organization and the family should have.
I just want to add one thing.
The families are often totally at sea when their son or daughter gets taken, and they're just not prepared for this situation. And one of the things that we need to do is to help them in future.
Of course. Robert Mahoney is Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and he'll be speaking on a panel entitled Journalism on the Ground, The Risks and Importance of International Reporting. That's at the World Affairs Council in Philadelphia this Thursday at 7:15 p.m. Thanks much for being here today.
You're welcome.
I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowane.